Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
This week on a special bonus episode of Meat and Three, we're celebrating Mardi Gras with an ode to the king cake, the most delicious custom of carnival season.
This is kind of like terrible comparison, but it's kind of like a braided New Orleans babka, if you really think about the actual technique of it.
Do we know why they put a baby in the cake yet?
You'd better be careful where you get that cake, because your friends and coworkers in New Orleans are going to have an opinion about it.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is a still mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Mark Crumpy, who is a chef and owner of Southern Hospitality Kitchen in Lafayette, Louisiana, and Emily Crumpy, his daughter. And Mark has a unique relationship with Japanese cuisine through his wife's heritage. His interest in Japanese food has developed over time, and he now beautifully incorporates Japanese and Southern American elements on his dishes. Mark is also a chef devoted to sustainability. So today we'll discuss Mark's unique family background, how he studied Japanese cuisine, how he naturally integrated Japanese and Southern American cooking together, his efforts to be local, sustainable, and global at the same time, and much, much more. But quickly, before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And I have a quick announcement. So I wrote a book about Japanese food, and it came out in Japan in December last year. Now it's available worldwide on Amazon website. It is called A Complete Guide to Japanese Cuisine, and the Japanese title is 英語でガイド、外国人が一番食べたい和食90選。There are two titles because it's written in both English and Japanese side by side. And the book is a mini encyclopedia of Japanese food, and it covers 90 dishes, sweets, and beverages with fun facts along with the foundational philosophy and history of Japanese cuisine. And each dish has a beautiful picture. And you can bring the book with you on your trip to Japan or to your favorite Japanese restaurant as a guidebook. And if you work at a Japanese restaurant, it can be your go-to reference. Also, if you are already familiar with Japanese food, the book is useful to explain the basics of Japanese food accurately to non-Japanese people. Or it can be a fun textbook for both English and Japanese language learners. It is available worldwide on the Amazon website as well as in bookstores in Japan and some bookstores outside of Japan, such as Kinokuniya. Again, the title is A Complete Guide to Japanese Cuisine, and in Japanese, 英語でガイド、外国人が一番食べたい和食90選。I hope you will enjoy reading it. Now, let's start a conversation with Mark Crumpy and Emily Crumpy. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hi, Emily.
Hi.
So, first of all, where are you from? And what did you eat when you grew up?
So I was born in Lafayette, Louisiana, and my parents split when I was younger. So at my mom's house, who was born and raised in that area, we had a lot of rice and gravy probably every day, and just braised meats. That's the thing about Cajun cooking, and there's a lot of long cooks from the French heritage and braised vegetables, and they kind of cook the crap out of everything.
Right.
And then my dad was from Ohio and lived in California for a while, so it was kind of all over the place with him. He would do fresh noodles for stroganoff from like his grandmother, his mom from Germany, and he would make corned beef hash. That was probably his favorite breakfast.
Wow.
And then he would bring me traveling a lot. So I got to eat a lot of cool things when I was younger and kind of broaden my horizons early on. Got me started really loving different cultures, cuisines.
Wow. What an exposure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're lucky because in my case, my parents are really only eating Japanese food mainly. Yeah. So yeah, everything was new to me as I got older. But so that's how you got into cooking?
Yeah. As I think about like my childhood memories, I kind of attach a lot of them to food and taste and different places we went. So early on, I just really enjoyed being in the kitchen with my family, cooking dinners and just having like family over and parties. And I never thought about it as a career. I just thought it was a, you know, means to an end when I finished college, just working in kitchens and trying to make my way through school. And I didn't really think about it until halfway through college when I was like, man, I could probably do this for a living.
Wow.
And I dropped out of college and went to culinary school.
Mm. So there was a moment like, wow, I'm good at this.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow. What was the dish or something that the experience that sparked yourself?
It was my now wife, who is my girlfriend at the time, gave me the confidence, like, you can do this as a career. And when I moved to Austin, I met some really cool chefs, and I think it was after I ate at Uchi Austin.
Mm-hmm.
It was right when they opened. And after that meal, I was like, man, I would love to do this for a living.
Mm.
Just like the memory of that dinner and all the other memories I have, I was thinking like, you can be a part of someone's life without ever meeting them. Like, they have a lasting memory of something that you created for them.
Mm.
And I really enjoyed that.
That's interesting. Right. It's almost like cultural experience.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, but Uchi is very, it's not Japanese. That's another beautiful part of it.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
It's, he integrates so many different flavors and techniques, and that's why I loved it so much. It was just really cool how we could take all these different cultures and put them together and have a successful restaurant.
Right. So, and I heard you also studied culinary arts, the Texas Culinary Academy.
Yeah, at Le Cordon Bleu in Austin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So you have a kind of French technique.
Yes.
Right. So
that's what I enjoyed about going there. It kind of gave me a good basis of like mother sauces and techniques and stuff like that that I hadn't quite learned everything yet.
Right. So probably that would give you confidence that I know the basics.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay. And so before you became the chef and owner of Southern Hospitality Kitchens, which we're going to talk about in a moment, you started at restaurants specializing in French, Japanese, New American, Thai cuisine. So why so global?
I guess from my childhood and traveling, I just really loved all these different cuisines and like how much you could learn just from one cuisine and techniques, and you go to another one, there's this whole other like spectrum of flavors and ingredients. And I had my oldest daughter at the time, well, second oldest, and I couldn't really afford to work at the cooler restaurants or smaller restaurants. So on my weekends and days off, I would go stage. I would pick like a Japanese place or a French one, or there's this really cool Ethiopian one I loved going to as well. She would have her spices brought in by her cousin in Ethiopia, like every 3 months. And I just really enjoyed it. And it was just amazing to see. You could experience someone's culture just by sitting in the kitchen with them.
Right. Interesting. So the concept of, like, people negatively think of fusion, and I don't like the fusion. Fusion is like confusion, people say.
Yeah, yeah.
But the way you grew up naturally, surrounded by different flavors into one table. And I had another discussion with New American chef.
Yeah.
And he said the beauty of New American cuisine is that you can do anything as far as you're responsible for the taste.
Yeah.
That really well said.
That's what I love about it.
Right. So in 2013, you became the chef and owner of Southern Hospitality Kitchens. So what is Southern Hospitality Kitchens, and how do you become the chef and owner of that?
So, I was working at the time in Austin, Texas, and a restaurateur from Louisiana was interested in bringing me over there to help him grow his brand and open some new restaurants and concepts. And they came and visited me in Austin, and I showed them around, and it was a really good opportunity for me to kind of springboard my career and become a chef owner and learn new things. And this restaurateur has been around since the 70s. So we got together, and it was a great fit, and we started Southern Hospitality Kitchens, and he already had a restaurant that had been open since the early 80s, Charlie G's. So I bought a small ownership in that, and we kind of started from there, and that's where we opened Social, which is like my baby. That's what I started from the ground up.
Right. So we have the Charlie G's, which is a kind of a grilling aged beef, freshly done.
Yeah, seafood. It's like a fine dining steak and seafood restaurant with like Creole influences.
Right. And the tap room, that's like wings, hot dogs.
Yeah, it's like American. Your typical American bar, 50 taps, bunch of whiskey, decent food for a bar setting.
And they have a Pete's that's like makeup sports.
That's like the family sports bar. That was another one that's been around since the 80s, and we kind of took over and tried to revitalize it. Place for people to bring their families and kids and eat and drink.
Right. So out of the four restaurants, Social, Southern Table and Bar, that's kind of your playground?
Yeah, yeah.
Where you are.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so Louisiana is a very special place with micro-culinary cultures.
Yes.
And so what is unique about Lafayette versus like places like New Orleans?
So yeah, Lafayette's different as far as like, I guess, Cajun and Creole cooking go. In New Orleans, you have more of the Caribbean influences and the Spanish influences from the slave trade. And Lafayette was started by the Acadians from Canada, so it's heavy French influences. So you have a lot of braises and a lot of like whole animal cookery, and they were, you know, poor people, so they tried to use it. Everything they could.
Which actually makes everything delicious.
Better it definitely does.
Right. Oh, I didn't know that. So that's why it's more like heavy braised.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Long time cooking. Interesting. So what's a classic Lafayette style? Like examples of cuisine?
Classic Lafayette style cuisines. I guess I'd have to say crawfish etouffee. Which is just like a, you know, crawfish and gravy. It's got the holy trinity of Cajun. It's celery, onion, and bell peppers cooked down with garlic and stock, and make a roux with it over rice. So it's a lot of rice and gravy. Gumbo there is different from New Orleans. The gumbos in New Orleans I find to be a little darker, heavier. And what's another Cajun dish?
Yeah, you got your shrimp okra in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Jambalaya.
Yeah, jambalaya is another one. And
there's Mark's friends here, so hi, kid.
And the boucherie is probably a first time I experienced something like that was in Lafayette.
Okay.
Kind of everybody gets together, and you kill a pig in the morning, and everybody breaks it down, and everybody has their different stations.
Oh,
and
wow.
You make all these different things with the entire animal.
So
it's just the flavors are just completely different. It's almost hard to explain until you really taste it. It's just a lot of braised items with a lot of rice and gravy.
Right. So of course, Japan is a country of rice, but the rice, in a way, in the South, it's used to absorb the braised liquid, which is
that's
rich.
What I loved about. It's the first time I had like really good Japanese like short grain rice. Like the flavor of it, and just on its own, was amazing. It helped like highlight the fish. And back home, it was more of like potatoes and gravy is just there to soak everything up and eat together.
Right. So regular rice used in the South, that's a long grain?
Or? Yeah. And but lately we've been having more, I guess, smaller production farmers coming up with different rices, like the Louisiana popcorn rice.
Mm, what is that?
So it's from a, I guess a rice grain from, I want to say Thailand maybe. And it has this specific popcorn flavor and smell. Oh. So if you're standing at the rice fields and the wind blows, it smells like buttered popcorn.
Oh, wow.
And when we cook it in the restaurant, the whole kitchen smells like buttered popcorn.
Oh, wow.
So it adds a whole another element to the dish rather than just being there as a vessel to hold the gravies.
Mm. So is that a new grain, like new crop hybrid or ancient?
Yeah, it's a hybrid.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I want to try that.
Cross the local grain with the an Asian one, and it's absolutely amazing.
Mm. Yeah, I think there is a movement to revive the ancient grains as well as to even enhance those flavors.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Right? So that sounds like it's happening.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. And so you have a very unique connection with Japan. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so my wife is actually part Japanese. Her family, she still has family there. Her, I guess we'll start with her grandmother. Her grandmother was born in Argentina, but her father was the head
That's
of
the... That's interesting.
Yeah.
Already.
Yeah, so it was an arranged marriage. Her grandmother's father was a head of the Japanese consulate. It was arranged marriage with a someone in the royal family of Argentina, and so she was born in Argentina.
Oh.
And from there, she moved to.
So this is so the grandmother is a child of immigrants.
Yes.
That was like I think early 19th
yes.
century. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of Japanese people.
Yes.
To look for something mm-hmm. like that was a very hard time in Japan mm-hmm. economically. So that's a very, very interesting start.
It's even when you go back farther, her like great grandfather was a samurai and he converted to Christianity.
Whoa.
And he ended up being the first Methodist bishop in Japan.
Oh my God. Let's make a movie.
It's really cool to go and sit in her dad's house and like look through all the old photos and listen to him talk about it. It's really, really neat.
Mm.
But yeah, so her grandmother was born in Argentina. From there, she moved to Mexico City, Chile, and I think Panama.
Okay, her husband was...
So she hadn't met her husband yet.
Okay.
They moved back to Tokyo during World War II.
Okay, I keep interrupting, but the... your wife's grandmother,
yes.
Born and raised in Argentina,
mm-hmm.
and got married and moved around for parents' job or?
Well, yeah, so her father was a Japanese consulate.
Okay, wow.
And so he was over there, and then they would move him around South America.
Mm.
And then when World War II started, they called him back to Japan.
Right.
And so they moved back to Tokyo.
Oh, interesting.
And then that's where her grandmother met her husband. He was a writer for the Stars and Stripes,
mm-hmm.
and he was from Mexico.
Okay.
And he was a writer over there in Tokyo, and that's where they met.
Wow.
And then she immigrated back to the United States with her husband to Austin, Texas.
Oh, my God. How many nationalities involved here?
There we go. Japanese, Argentinian, and Mexican.
Right. Yeah. And then all those, around all those cultural... Oh, yeah.
That's what I love about like going through old recipes. You can see influences from all over South America, Mexico, Japan.
Right. So, and then that's your wife's grandparents.
Yes. Yes.
So to get through to you, what's the story?
Well, so they moved to Austin, Texas, and then they had kids and... he became a professor at UT, and he was started the Mexican American Folklore Center there. And then, you know, her grandmother had my wife's dad there, and she was born in Austin. And when I was my first year in college, I wasn't enjoying school very much, so I took a road trip to Austin, Texas, and just to stay for the weekend, and ended up staying. Mm. For 11 years.
Oh, wow. What happened?
I just enjoyed it so much. I just loved the the people there. It was a big city, small town feel. I loved the food. Mm. I loved the barbecue culture. I just loved everything about it. It just felt like home.
Mm. And that was before Austin became Austin.
Like when I moved to Austin, it was right before it kind of started to explode as a culinary destination.
Mm. Right. So South by Southwest. It
wasn't crazy. There's a lot of festivals there that are so big now. I mean, I remember going to one festival and you could get in with a canned good.
Mm.
And now tickets are, you know, $100 a pop.
Right. So then your wife influenced you currently terms? Like, you know, like she, I don't know how much, so she's the eighth Japanese, yeah. Right?
It's funny, her dad influenced me more. When I met my wife, she wasn't a very adventurous eater. Mm. She would eat stuff at home and I'd have to like trick her, talk her into going to other places. So I think I've kind of broadened her horizon more than she has me. But yeah, her father and I really hit it off over food, and he started sharing with me his mother's recipes.
Mm.
And I would cook them for him and he would get all sentimental and like, man, this tastes just like my mom used to make.
Wow.
So I just really enjoyed like going through the old recipes. Mm. And
that's a very, very responsible cooking.
Yes.
You can't mess with the memories.
Oh, I mean, I remember the first few times I made him some stuff, I was very, very nervous.
Mm.
But yeah, so then I became like the family, the head of the family parties, and when we'd cook and he'd have his family over. And I think their big thing they'd cook a lot was the sukiyaki.
Mm.
So we'd have everybody over and I'd be at the table putting everything together. And yeah, it was just fun.
Right.
A lot of fun.
So Emily, what do you think about your dad's cooking, Japanese cooking?
It's really good.
Yeah? So he's talented. So what's your favorite?
I don't know.
There are too many?
Yeah.
All right.
Probably sweet and sour pork.
Yeah.
That was the first time I didn't know, I don't know the Japanese name for it or what dish it is, but
it's called tsubuta.
Yeah.
It's I think came from China, like kind of Chinese influence.
Yes.
But it's Japanese.
It's awesome. And it was so simple. And I remember the first time I cooked it, you didn't saute the vegetables. You just kind of threw everything in and let it cook. And I was really freaked out about it, but it just so simple and amazing.
Right. And that the vinegar really,
you know, the cuts vinegar,
through,
yeah,
the fat.
The soy sauce, vinegar, and sugar, and you just let it cook, and the fattiness of the pork. That's one of my favorite dishes.
I can eat it right now. So maybe next time I visit.
Oh, definitely.
Good. Off menu item. Okay. So, yeah. So, so that's how you basically learned Japanese basic cooking.
Yeah. From looking through her her recipes and just kind of studying online and buying books and reading and trial and error. And the first restaurant I worked at outside of culinary school was Maiko in Austin. And I learned a lot there.
Mm.
From the chef there. He had worked at Uchi and some other places.
Oh.
And just sitting there and watching him and learning. And that's when I fell in love with tempura. And my wife really can't eat it anywhere else except for Uchi, because there's not very many places that do it properly.
Mm.
And that's what I love about Japanese cuisine, is like the simplicity of it. But if it's done correctly, it's absolutely amazing.
Right. And to get there, you have to
razor
sharp.
Yeah. Years and years. And that's another thing I really enjoy about it, just the dedication to their craft and what they do.
Mm. Yeah. And do you go to Japan too? Or?
I've been once. We took a trip to Vietnam last year and we had a little stopover in Japan. And I want to go longer, but my wife would have killed me if I went without her, because she hasn't been yet and she wants to go and see her family. And there's actually a statue of her great-grandfather in Tokyo.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
And her, I think her aunt and uncle took a picture in front of it, so we want to go and take a picture in front of it.
Yeah, it's gonna get the red carpet.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. All right, so we'll take a quick break here, and then when we come back we'll talk about how Mark incorporates Japanese elements in southern dishes naturally. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs, broadcasting live from studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Mark Crumpy, who is a chef and owner of Southern Hospitality Kitchens in Lafayette, Louisiana. He manages four kitchens in the beautiful South. So I heard that you are already into Japanese culture before even you met your wife.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you become interested in Japanese culture?
It started when I was in, this is like the fourth grade. My stepdad was going to take a job in Denver, and he took me up there to look at houses, and we ate at this little sushi bar in downtown Denver. And it was like, I was just mesmerized watching him sit there and prepare the fish and cut it, and him talk about all the stuff he had behind the sushi bar. And that was the first time I saw and tried gooey duck. And it was just very interesting to me. And so from then on, I just would read books about Japan and the history. And I just fell in love with the culture and cuisine.
Mm.
And I never thought I'd be cooking it at one point. I just enjoyed eating it.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So that's very, like you said earlier, it's a very kind of a spiritual attitude towards food and by the Japanese, especially sushi chefs, I think.
Oh, so. Yeah. I don't know. Going to some, like, that place or somewhere that they put so much love and dedication into it, it just feels different when you eat the food.
Mm.
You can feel their passion for it and their dedication.
Right. Also, I think there is a very strict culture in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
And you have to be like that.
Oh,
like
yeah.
A martial arts kind of. Yeah, I think it still continues that way,
uh-huh.
I think. But so you said earlier, you know, before the break, so Japanese food is special to you because, like, craftsmanship, you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can you talk a little more about that?
As opposed, like, as to my cooking or?
Give me anything.
I just really admire and enjoy how much time and effort they put into making something so perfect or as close to perfection as they can be. And I enjoy sitting in a kitchen and working on something over and over again and trying to get it as perfect as possible, and watching someone eat that and kind of feel it and understand it at the same time. It's just like a beautiful thing.
Right. And also I think a lot of people like chef knives.
Yeah.
And I understand it because I would never ever be able to make this precious knife.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like nothing. It's like worshiping this.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because you know it becomes part of your hand.
Yes, I love knives, and I really enjoy sharpening. That's like one of my favorite things to do in the kitchen, and kind of calms me down and focuses me. And I probably have way too many knives.
How many do you have?
One, two, three, probably 10 or 12. I've collected them over the years.
Mm.
David gave me one.
Okay.
When I became an Oura King ambassador. My wife this year got me one. She got me an appointment with Phillips Forge to make one for me. I've never had one made like personally for me.
Wow.
So it's fun going through the process of picking out the metal and the wood for the handle and everything.
Oh, wow.
And so it'll be, he's making me like a 12-inch sushi knife. That'll be my first one like that.
Can I get a little nerdy? Like, yeah. You know, you can just choose the ingredients. So basically, so what's the difference between Japanese and Western knives?
So I think it's the main difference I see is the hardness and softness of the steel.
Mm.
Like I have a German knife that I've had since culinary school, and that's what I use to butcher whole animals and cut through bones, and it holds its edge for much longer. It's very, very hard steel. As opposed to all my Japanese knives, I have to sharpen them much more frequently.
Because it's soft.
Yeah, they'll use like a soft steel in the middle and then a harder one on the outside. So your edge, you can get razor sharp, but it dulls much more quickly than, say, like a German steel.
So in other words, the more you take care of it,
yes,
it's like reliable.
Exactly,
friend.
Yeah.
Right. And
I would notice that the first sushi place I worked in, you'd see the sushi chefs sharpen their knives every day before the shift.
Okay. And it's so, you know, Western knives are two-sided, right?
Like, yeah, so you have like the Western edge, which is the two-sided, or you can do just the right or left.
So you prefer one-sided or two-sided?
So I like two-sided for like my everyday stuff, but I like one-sided for when I'm cutting fish and stuff like that. And I just started the Tsubiki technique, where you cut the scales off the fish for dry aging. And so I like to use like the one-sided knife. Chef I've been talking to does it a lot. He had told me about it.
Because you can make it more thinly.
Yeah, more thinly, and keep that nice straight line all the way through. It's easier to kind of keep it straight as you go across the fish.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's like fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, the best gadget. Okay. So I was lucky to have an opportunity to visit your restaurant, Social Sun Table and Bar, last year as a judge of a culinary competition. And you were one of the finalists to cook multiple creative dishes. And I was pleasantly surprised how skillfully you incorporated Japanese elements in your American style cooking. For example, you cured salmon tail with koji, which is a foundational ingredient for Japanese cuisine, to increase umami and sweetness. And you made peanut miso, which had deep sweetness, nuttiness, and some tropical fruit note. And I the secret was yuzu, yeah. I think. And also, you flavored salmon loin with miso, and result was amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, so how did you learn to use Japanese ingredients and techniques, like, to kind of weave into other elements?
Just a lot of trial and error and getting lucky. I first noticed how you could do it when I went to Uchi in Austin, and how well he did it. So I just, when I would eat a southern dish and I'd think about it, like, well, I could use, you know, miso to bring up the salinity of the dish and also enhance umami. Or, you know, curing stuff with koji. There's just a lot of, you know, trial and error and working on it. And just kind of trying to enhance my stocks and broths with like kombu or bonito and stuff like that, instead of the traditional stuff we'd use around the South.
Yeah, I think the way you use them, Japanese elements, tend to be very subtle.
Yeah.
And you don't know
looking at it. Yeah, that's another thing, where we live. People, it's hard for them to get and try different new things. So I have to sneak them into dishes, and right. I can't even put them in the description of the dish, or they won't order it. So I've gotten really good at sneaking something in, and just to, not to highlight that ingredient, but to add another level to the flavor.
Right. I think thanks to the ramen boom, I think a lot of chefs, Western chefs, learned how to make dashi.
Yes.
And I keep hearing, what is that? That's secretly, there's dashi in it. So that's the umami enhancer.
Oh, yeah. We did a, during the winter, we do a crawfish ramen. And I make like a roasted crawfish dashi, like from the shells and stuff of the crawfish.
You can't go wrong with that.
Oh, no. It's really good. We do like toasted rye noodles with that as well. And then we'll use local vegetables. That's kind of the garnishes and stuff like that.
Okay. So maybe you can give us some examples dishes on your menu at Social Southern Table and Bar that have Japanese influence.
Yeah. So probably the most popular one that we've had since we opened are our crab nachos with crab with a K. We use kani sticks from Japan.
Okay, so what's kani sticks?
the crab meat, the crab sticks that are actually not crab. They use different fish for that. And
It looks like crab because
it looks like crab. Yes,
like red.
Most sushi bars you go to, if they say they have snow crab, that's what they're using.
Yeah, it's open secret.
Yes. So we take that one and we mix it with our house-made spicy mayo, and we put it on top of a little wonton chip that we make in-house, and then some yuzu guacamole, which we just use fresh avocados, right. Yuzu juice.
So instead of lime, you use yuzu. So what's the effect compared to?
I feel like it brightens it and adds a tropical note to the creaminess of the avocado, and then it just goes really well with, I mean, people love those kani sticks and spicy mayo. And then the other one I was talking about was the crawfish ramen. We do the crawfish dashi. We do the toasted rye ramen noodles.
Wow.
And we top it with like the sauteed crawfish. And we do the aji tomago, the cured eggs, and then different pickles and stuff that we get from our local farmers. As far as other dishes, we change our menu quite frequently. So we do like the koji cured salmon or miso rub salmon, stuff like that, kind of sneak it in there. And I've actually put miso in our gumbo before.
Right. Well, by the way, that salmon dish, like miso salmon, is like miso cod all over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But koji is kind of enhanced sweetness.
Yeah, the koji adds a whole nother flavor to, especially that salmon dish, especially the oraking, just the fattiness and richness of that salmon and the koji.
So oraking is a natural, supernaturally farmed salmon.
Yes.
And delicious.
It's absolutely amazing. I never was really into salmon until I was able to try oraking. It's on a whole nother level.
Right.
And I've converted a lot of my customers, and I was a little afraid and apprehensive to put it on our menu because of the price point, and are they going to pay more for this salmon as opposed to someone down the street? And I've like tripled my sales on that salmon.
Oh wow!
Once they try it, they're hooked.
Right, because you feel clean after tasting the fat, which is precious.
It's it's unbelievable. Like when you break down a whole oraking, and I'll scrape the bones. To make like spicy salmon bowls and stuff like that. And if you leave the flesh on your cutting board and come back, there's like a pool of fat just around it. Or like when you smoke it, I had some when I was in New Zealand, and it was smoked. They wrapped it in butcher paper. We had it all day with us. We brought it back to the Airbnb and we were going to eat it. And when we opened it, there was just fat just through the butcher paper. It was like when we'd be back home in Texas and you'd have some brisket wrapped up in butcher paper and you go to open it up, it's just like covered in grease.
Wow, so full of omega-3.
Oh, yeah, nice. It's unbelievable.
Right. Okay, so, so you said that you keep changing menu, like seasonally or even more often?
Yeah, seasonally or more often. Whenever we have something on the menu and it's kind of going out of season or we want to change it up, we print our own menus in-house, so we just kind of change it up whenever we want to. It's hard to do where we live because people like what they like and they want to come back and they'll get upset if it's not there. So we have like our staples and then we change like the rest of the menu whenever we feel
that's
like it.
A happy problem.
Yes, it is.
That means you have very successful dishes.
Yeah, we try.
Yeah. So, but speaking of, you know, you have to have seasonal ingredients to keep the cost down as well as being sustainable, which I want to discuss. So how do you become so sustainable oriented, chef?
It was more about wanting to help the local community and small production artisans and farmers, and the quality of the product as well. Just getting it from the, like, produce, for example, getting it from a larger distributor, it loses some of its flavor and the freshness, and you can tell that the product spoils much more quickly.
Mm.
As opposed to getting it from someone local, it may be more expensive, but I have way less waste, and
right. The
freshness and the flavor comes through on the dish. It's just hard educating the customer on why they're paying more for this lettuce on the salad as opposed to somewhere down the street that uses more commercially grown stuff.
It's, if you know, compare, like, side by side, it's hands down.
Yeah, yeah. You'll definitely pay more for it. It's just hard getting them to that point.
Right. Yeah, I used to buy supermarket organic eggs. And then I happened to stumble onto really expensive farm eggs, like farmers deliver to my nearby butcher. I can't go back.
Oh, no.
It's like double the price.
Yeah.
But do you know, it's good for you. The color is different. And
it's so worth it.
Right.
We have a local farmer that delivers to us once a week all of our eggs. And we started off doing, like, part commercial eggs for some of our bigger stuff, like all of our biscuits we make. And then we've just slowly gone to completely farm-raised eggs. And you can just tell the difference in the end product.
Right. Why bother eating food?
Yeah.
Because it's good.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. So, so it's your, but you do global things. I was impressed. Instead of purchasing imported miso.
Yeah.
You made like peanut miso.
Yeah.
That's how you try to be sustainable in terms
of... Yeah, I try to be sustainable, and I'm trying to take more local ingredients and kind of give them a more global twist, or use, you know, other cultures' techniques on them. So I can still be local and sustainable, but be able to use stuff from other countries.
Right. And that inspires Japanese producers,
yes,
too. Right. Yeah, like peanut miso is really interesting.
Oh, yeah. I just love the richness of it. It's, like, super clean. It's fantastic. And I just planted my first yuzu tree at a social. Yeah.
Right. Does it grow there?
Yes. It's blossoming right now. I was worried, but it loves where I put it. And it's got, like, 30 blossoms on it right now. It fruited last year already. I was surprised. It was the first year I put it in the ground, and we got like 8 fruit off of it.
That's interesting. I was always wondering why use.
Yeah.
Is it not available here? So
yeah, I can't find it anywhere. Towards the end of when I lived in Austin, I'd start seeing it in a local grocery store every once in a while. But when it would come in, you could get barely any juice from it because it was so old, the inside and dehydrated. But now that I know I can grow it in the South, I'm really excited. I'm going to plant some more.
Wow. There could be a big boom of usage.
Yeah.
Because everybody wants it, but
it's
too expensive.
Oh, I know. My our friend Mary, she's half Japanese, and she's always, like, bringing me different Japanese ingredients and wanting me to try. She makes her own udon and ramen, and she got me hooked on natto.
Yeah, but natto, I think... You know, I had natto producers twice on this show, but by making natto by yourself, when you buy it here, it's frozen already.
Oh, yeah. When I had it when I was in Japan, it blew my mind how much better it was.
Right? Yeah, even I tried the same brand, but it tastes so different.
Oh, it's not the same. Over there, it's weird. The flavor, the texture, everything about it's different.
Right. I heard it. I've never tried it yet, but the natto is not too hard to make.
Yeah, I don't think it would be.
Right. So, look forward to your report. Yeah, I was just curious, you know, like, you have many local farms to work with, right? So, what are the examples of good farms that you love working with?
So, there's one main one we work with is Covey Rise Farms. They're outside of New Orleans. But the thing I love about them is they have the stuff they farm, as well as they do pig farming. but they drive kind of down the Gulf Coast and up a little further, and they pick up from local farms on their route.
Mm.
And when they come to me, I mean, I can get like apples from North Carolina and different stuff along the Gulf Coast.
Wow.
And they go all the way to Houston. So that's what I really love about them. I can get stuff that's super, super local, and then I can kind of get stuff along the South and, you know, below the Mason-Dixon line from them.
Right. Yeah, what I heard about New York City Farmers Market, before markets are set up, farmers didn't have any root to sell. Even if they grow all those things, they didn't have any manpower or marketing.
Yeah, that was the hard thing about us, is you have all these local producers, but they can't get their product out there. They don't have any delivery methods and distribution. That's what I like about Covey Rise and JV Foods. They pick up from all these local producers and then bring them to chefs.
Mm, nice.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Wow. Okay. And so also, I was very impressed that you have a donation program to support local nonprofit organization. And many restaurants may want to do it, but they don't because it's hard.
So, yeah.
So why do you think it's important to do that?
It just goes back to helping support the community and give back. The community supports us, helps us pay our bills, helps me pay our employees who support their families. And, you know, it's just a big circle, keeping the community together and just helping everyone we can. So we do, you know, special dinners. We'll give back portions of different items or dinners we do. Right now we're doing Hogs for the Cause, which is out of New Orleans, and it helps support pediatric brain cancer.
Mm.
That's a massive one. And us three are actually on a team together.
Oh,
it's
wow.
A big, like, whole hog cook-off competition. It's a lot of fun.
Right. And, so do you think it's hard to think of that kind of efforts in New York City because there's so many people, many restaurants, so many charities. And is that Lafayette thing, like cultural, precious culture there?
Oh, yeah. It's just a big community there. And it's just like the friends you make, and you want to support and help everyone that you can. And I can see how it would be hard in New York because there's so many people and so many things you could do or give back to. And,
right.
Yeah, it's got to be tough.
Right. And this is the city where somebody talks to you, like, what do you want?
Yeah.
You don't trust people.
Yeah.
Like, you can't trust, basically. But, yeah, that's like Southern hospitality.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So, so finally, what's your plan?
Plan? I'd actually like to branch out of, you know, Louisiana and go to some larger markets. Mm. I'd love to bring social to larger markets. I have a lot of people that come in from bigger cities and like, oh, we don't have anything like this here, has this feel. Or so I would love to bring social somewhere. And I've been secretly working on an izakaya project, just kind of by myself, drawing stuff and making menus. And I'd love to take social's like Southern feel and fuse it with the izakaya, like American sports bar type feel.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? What have you been doing? You have the kind of business models.
Exactly. Yeah. Because social, you know, we were the last 5 years one of the best bourbon bars in America.
Oh, wow.
As far as my other bars, I'm absolutely amazing. So I'd like to take those two things and kind of fuse them into a izakaya type feel.
Right. And also by expanding, you can try more local, different items. Yeah. You're very curious,
I
think.
Yes.
And experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I get bored easily.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
All right. So where can we find your social?
So all the restaurants you can find on BeRealEatGood.com. And then you can follow me on Instagram. I'm a Wandering Chef. WanderingChef.
Cool. All right, so good luck.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's great seeing you again.
Yeah, you're going to come back, maybe?
Oh, yeah, I would love to.
Right, definitely. And maybe after a trip to Japan, then we discover more.
That would be amazing.
Right. All right, so thank you for joining us today, Mark and Emily.
Thank you.
Right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.